This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of audio reading service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Mike with
Brittany.
For the next 2 hours, we will be reading selections from the Thursday, September 11th, Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, copyright 2025. We'll begin with news for the first hour and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read obituaries, then a number of features from the living section. After that, we'll read from the perspective section, including letters to the editor and editorials. After editorials, we'll read the TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. The headlines from the front page of the Thursday, September 11th, Journal Gazette are conservative activist Charlie Cook assassinated, slain at Utah University rally. Shot from rooftop, police say. Motive unknown. Person of interest sought. Late fire study factor in budget council has questions about effects of delay. Drones from Russia cross into Poland. NATO jets scramble to shoot them down. Mars rover findings hint at ancient life. Now, here's Brittany with the first article.
Late fire study factor in budget. Council has questions about effects of delay. By Tony Sandelman at the Journal Gazette. At least one Allen County Council member is concerned about making budget decisions without seeing a study on county fire districts. The Allen County Commissioners paid more than $45,000 this year for a Purdue University Fort Wayne team to study the logistics of consolidating 4 fire districts and 1 fire territory into 1 countywide district. The university's engineering department started gathering information in March, and the results were expected in June. Councilwoman Lindsay Hammond, Republican at large, said with the hearing for the next 2026 budget next week, not having those results could affect her vote on the fire district's budgets. "They really need to come in and give us an update on where that stands," she said. "We have fire districts we have to approve budgets for, and they're making staffing decisions, equipment decisions, making decisions on cash reserves and things like that, and we really need to know what the future looks like." Councilman Tom Harris, Republican of the 2nd, said he expects to hear an update next week, either before or during the budget hearing. County department representatives will present their budget proposals to council at a public hearing for members to consider before the October 8th vote. "I spoke to one of the chiefs last week, and he indicated that they were just about there," Harris said. "There's 2 or 3 groups that are formulating the final report, and they had not done a tweaking of the final report, and that's what's been holding it up." Commissioner Rich Beck, who has been involved in talks about the study, said he doesn't expect the results to come out next week. "I didn't get a next week feeling from the discussions," he said. "The representative for the chiefs at Purdue met yesterday to make final changes, and my understanding is that they're shooting for some time in the next couple of weeks." Councilman Josh Hale, Republican of the 1st, is the chief of the East Central Fire Territory. Hale said he has not been actively involved in the study, but has experience budgeting for a fire department. He said Hammond's questions about the study's results' potential impact on the budget are valid. "The study could call for a significant financial investment in building projects that could affect future budgets. That kind of investment would need to be considered this year, but he said it's important that the consolidation is handled correctly. The commissioners that are creating the fire district are essentially making decisions that could impact his community for the next 20 years or longer," Hale said. "So it's certainly not something that we want to rush into." Harris said it would have been helpful to get the study before budget season, but he does not expect it to play a major role in the 2026 budget decisions. "That study is long-lasting and probably a year or two out before we take action on it," he said. "But we'll have to see if the study itself to understand if this is the stuff we have to do in 27 or 26, and I would anticipate this would probably be a 27-28 decision rather than next year. Hammond said the results are crucial to her vote on the 2026 budgets. The hearing is set for 8:30 a.m. September 18th at Citizens Square. We need to answer those questions before we go in and make decisions after these budgets, she said after the meeting. If those questions have not been satisfied, I don't think I can, in good conscience, vote on any of these budgets. In other business, council was scheduled to discuss tax abatements for Shojin Global Incorporated, a company that has proposed investing more than $46.8 million to establish an energy storage system in an existing 150,000-square-foot shell building at 14322 Hitsfield Court near Roanoke. The abatement would save the company almost $3 million in property tax payments over 10 years. Shojin representatives asked to delay their abatement request because Councilman Robert Armstrong, Republican at large, and Paul Legaman, Republican of the Third, were absent. The tax abatement is set to be discussed at council's next regular meeting, October 8th.
Conservative activist Charlie Kirk assassinated, slain at Utah University rally, shot from rooftop, police say. Motive unknown, person of interest sought. By Associated Press, Dateline Orem, Utah. Charlie Kirk, a conservative activist and close ally of President Donald Trump, who played an influential role in rallying young Republican voters, was shot and killed Wednesday at a Utah college event in what the governor called a political assassination carried out from a rooftop. This is a dark day for our state. It is a tragic day for our nation, said Utah Governor Spencer Cox. I want to be very clear, this is a political assassination. No one was in custody late Wednesday, though authorities were searching for a new person of interest, according to a law enforcement official familiar with the matter who was not authorized to discuss the situation by name and spoke on condition of anonymity. Authorities had earlier provided evolving information on the status of the search, with FBI Director Kash Patel initially saying on social media that a subject had been taken into custody, only to later say the person had been released after being questioned. Authorities did not immediately identify the person who had been in custody, a motive, or any criminal charge. But the circumstances of the shooting drew renewed attention to an escalating threat of political violence in the United States that in the last several years has cut across ideological spectrum. The assassination drew bipartisan condemnation, but a national reckoning over ways to prevent political grievances from manifesting as deadly violence seemed elusive. Videos posted to social media from Utah Valley University show Kirk speaking into a handheld microphone while sitting under a white tent emblazoned with the slogans, "The American Comeback" and "Prove Me Wrong." A single shot rings out, and Kirk can be seen reaching up with his right hand as a large volume of blood gushes from the left side of his neck. Stunned spectators are heard gasping and screaming before people start to run away. The Associated Press was able to confirm the videos were taken at Sorenson Center Courtyard on the Utah Valley University campus. Kirk was speaking at a debate hosted by his nonprofit political organization. Immediately before the shooting, Kirk was taking questions from an audience member about mass shootings and gun violence. "Do you know how many transgender Americans have been mass shooters over the last 10 years?" the person asked. Kirk responded, "Too many." The questioner followed up, "Do you know how many mass shooters there have been in America over the last 10 years? Counting or not counting gang violence?" Kirk asked. Then a single shot rang out. The shooter, who Cox pledged would be held accountable in a state with the death penalty, wore dark clothing and fired from a roof on campus some distance away. The death was announced on social media by Trump, who praised the 31-year-old Kirk, the co-founder and CEO of the youth organization Turning Point USA, as great and even legendary. Later Wednesday, he released a recorded video from the White House in which he called Kirk a martyr for truth and freedom, and blame the rhetoric of the radical left for the killing. Utah Valley University said the campus was immediately evacuated and remained closed. Classes were canceled until further notice. Those still on campus were asked to stay in place until police officers could safely escort them off campus. Armed officers walked around the neighborhood bordering the campus, knocking on doors and asking for information on the shooter. Officers were seen looking at a photo on their phones and showing it to people to see if they recognized a person of interest. The event, billed as the first stop on Kirk's The American Comeback Tour, had generated a polarizing campus reaction. An online petition calling for university administrators to bar Kirk from appearing received nearly 1,000 signatures. The university issued a statement last week citing First Amendment rights and affirming its commitment to free speech, intellectual inquiry, and constructive dialogue. Last week, Kirk posted on X images of news clips showing his visit was sparking controversy. He wrote, "What's going on in Utah?" The shooting drew swift condemnation across the political aisle as Democratic officials joined Trump, who ordered flags lowered to half-staff and issued a presidential proclamation, and Republican allies of Kirk in decrying the violence. "The attack on Charlie Kirk is disgusting, vile, and reprehensible," Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom, who last March hosted Kirk on his podcast, posted on X. "The murder of Charlie Kirk breaks my heart. My deepest sympathies are with his wife, two young children, and friends," said Gabriella Giffords, the former Democratic congresswoman who was wounded in a 2011 shooting in her Arizona district. The shooting appeared poised to become part of a spike of political violence that has touched a range of ideologies and representatives of both major parties. The attacks include the assassination of a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband at their home in June, the firebombing of a Colorado parade to demand Hamas release hostages, and a fire set at the house of Pennsylvania's governor, who is Jewish, in April. The most notorious of these events is the shooting of Trump during a campaign rally last year. Former Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, a Republican who was at Wednesday's event, said in an interview on Fox News Channel that he heard one shot and saw Kirk go back. "It seemed like it was a close shot," Chaffetz said, who seemed shaken as he spoke. He said there was a light police presence at the event, and Kirk had some security, but not enough. "Utah is one of the safest places on the planet," he said, "and so we just don't have these types of things." Turning Point was founded in suburban Chicago in 2012 by Kirk, then 18, and William Montgomery, a Tea Party activist, to proselytize on college campuses for low taxes and limited government. It was not an immediate success. But Kirk's zeal for confronting liberals in academia eventually won over an influential set of conservative financiers. Despite early misgivings, Turning Point enthusiastically backed Trump after he clinched the GOP nomination in 2016. Kirk served as a personal aide to Donald Trump Jr., the president's eldest son, during the general election campaign. Soon, Kirk was a regular presence on cable TV, where he leaned into the culture wars and heaped praise on the then president. Trump and his son were equally effusive and often spoke at Turning Point conferences.
Drones from Russia cross into Poland. NATO jets scramble to shoot them down. Courtesy of the Associated Press, Dateline, Wołyń, Poland. Multiple Russian drones crossed into Poland in what European officials described Wednesday as a deliberate provocation, causing NATO to send fighter jets to shoot them down. A NATO spokesman said it was the first time the alliance confronted a potential threat in its airspace. A house was hit in the village of Viriki, in the Lublin region near the Ukrainian border. Mayor Bernard Błaszczuk told the TVP Info television news channel, "The roof was severely damaged, but no one was hurt. The incursion, which occurred during a wave of strikes by the Kremlin on Ukraine, and the NATO response swiftly raised fears that the war could spill over, a fear that has been growing in Europe as Russia steps up its attacks and peace efforts go nowhere. Poland requested an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on the drone incursion. South Korea's UN mission, which holds the council presidency this month, said the time was being discussed. Russia's defense ministry said it did not target Poland, while Belarus, a close ally of Moscow, said it tracked some drones that, quote, lost their course because they were jammed. However, Several European leaders said they believed the incursion amounted to an intentional expansion of Russia's assault against Ukraine. Russia's war is escalating, not ending, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas told the reporters in Brussels. What Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to do is test us. What happened in Poland is a game changer, and it should result in stronger sanctions. Polish airspace has been violated many times since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, but never on this scale in Poland nor anywhere else in NATO territory. Poland said some of the drones came from Belarus, where Russian and Belarusian troops have begun gathering for war games scheduled to start Friday. It was not immediately clear how many drones were involved. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk told Parliament 19 violations were recorded over 7 hours, but he said information was still being gathered. Polish authorities said 9 crash sites were found, with some of them hundreds of kilometers from the border. There are definitely no grounds to suspect that this was a course correction mistake or the like, German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius told the Parliament. These drones were very clearly put on this course deliberately. Dutch fighter jets came to Poland's aid and intercepted some drones. Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski later thanked the Dutch government for the magnificent performance of Dutch pilots in neutralizing the drones. NATO met to discuss the incident, which came 3 days after Russia's largest aerial attack on Ukraine since the war began. Tusk told Parliament that the first violation came at about 11:30 p.m. Tuesday, and the last was about 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Earlier, Defense Minister Vladislav Kosiniak-Kamysz wrote on X that more than 10 projects crossed into Polish airspace. What is new, in the worst sense of the word, is the direction from which the drones came. This was the first time in this war that they did not come from Ukraine as a result of errors or minor Russian provocations. For the first time, a significant portion of the drones came directly from Belarus, Tusk said in Parliament. The Russian Defense Ministry said its overnight strikes targeted Ukraine's military-industrial complex in the western regions of the country, which border Poland, with no planned targets on Polish territory. In an unusual message of outreach, the ministry said it was ready to hold consultations with Poland's defense ministry. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called it a, quote, extremely dangerous precedent for Europe, and called for Russia to feel the consequences.
Mars rover findings hint at ancient life by Associated Press, Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. NASA's Mars rover Perseverance has uncovered rocks in a dry river channel that may hold potential signs of ancient microscopic life, scientists reported Wednesday. They stressed that in-depth analysis is needed of the sample gathered there by Perseverance, ideally in labs on Earth, before reaching any conclusions. While acknowledging the latest analysis certainly is not the final answer, NASA's science mission chief, Nikki Fox, said it's the closest we've actually come to discovering ancient life on Mars. Roaming Mars since 2021, the rover cannot directly detect life, past or present. Instead, it carries a drill to penetrate rocks and tubes to hold the samples gathered from places judged most suitable for hosting life billions of years ago. The samples are awaiting retrieval to Earth, an ambitious plan that's on hold as NASA seeks cheaper, quicker options. Calling it an exciting discovery, a pair of scientists who were not involved in the study, SETI Institute's Janice Bishop and the University of Massachusetts Amherst Mario Parente, were quick to point out that non-biological processes could be responsible. That's part of the reason why we can't go so far as to say, aha, this is proof, positive of life, lead researcher Joel Hurwitz of Stony Brook University told the Associated Press. All we can say is one of the possible explanations is microbial life, but there could be other ways to make this set of features that we see. Either way, Hurwitz said it's the best, most compelling candidate yet in the rover search for potential signs of long-ago life. It was the 25th sample gathered. The tally is now up to 30. The findings appeared in the journal Nature. It would be amazing to be able to demonstrate conclusively that these features were formed by something that was alive on another planet billions of years ago, right? Hurwitz said. But even if that's not the case, it's a valuable lesson in all of the ways that nature can conspire to fool us. Collected last summer, the sample is from reddish, clay-rich mudstones in Neretva Vallis, a river channel that once carried water into Jezero Crater. This outcrop of sedimentary rock, known as the Bright Angel Formation, was surveyed by Perseverance's science instruments before the drill came out. Along with organic carbon, a building block of life, Hurwitz and his team found minuscule specks, dubbed poppy seeds and leopard spots, that were enriched with iron phosphate and iron sulfide. On Earth, these chemical compounds are the byproducts when microorganisms chomp down on organic matter. There is no evidence of microbes on Mars today, but if any had been present on ancient Mars, they too might have reduced sulfate minerals to form sulfides in such a lake as Jezero Crater, Bishop and Parente wrote in an accompanying editorial. There's no evidence of present-day life on Mars, but NASA, over the decades, has sent spacecraft to Mars in search of past watery environments that might have supported life way back when.
Northwest Allen County shares vision for Career Center. $50.6 million facility contingent on November 4th referendum. By Ashley Sabota, the Journal-Gazette. Carroll High School students will have on-campus access to nearly 30 career and technical education programs if plans for a $50.6 million facility become reality, the administrator told the board this week. Voters will determine the Career Center's fate with the November 4th operating referendum. If approved, the ballot measure would allow Northwest Allen County schools to annually collect up to $12 million in additional property taxes for 8 years. The district, which would seek $10 million in the first year, would use the money to staff the Career Center, among other personal needs. Plans for the new facility would have to stop the referendum fails, Superintendent Wayne Barker has said. Officials have said the Career Center could be ready for the 2027-28 academic year, when today's freshmen will all be juniors. Those students will be the first to graduate under Indiana's new high school diploma requirements, which promote work and career-based opportunities. Many career and technical education offerings are two-year programs. Proposed for a location near Carroll, the Career Center would house 21 programs, including 6 that would move into the high school and 2 that would move from non-district facilities, said Brandon Biting, Assistant Superintendent of Operations and Safety. We could eliminate some travel barriers for our students, he said Monday, of housing programs that are now off campus. 7 programs would remain at the high school's main building, bringing the total of campus offerings to 28, Biting said. He emphasized that career and technical education goes beyond what the term might suggest. It has evolved to include career exploration, career coaching, and industry certifications. We don't want to sell it short just by saying it's just career and tech ed, Biting said. It truly is an opportunity for students to really immerse themselves into a potential career. 13 new programs eyed for the facility include welding technology, landscaping, civil construction, early childhood education, hospitality management, criminal justice, and fire and rescue. Biting shared interior renderings of the Career Center. He assured the board that the facility is being designed so the district can add or adjust programs as necessary. Moak Park Group is the architectural firm attached to the project. We keep talking about the flexible spaces because we don't know what's going to be around in 20 years, Biting said. We want this space to be able to adapt to that. The proposed location, southwest of Carroll and north of Barrett Road, will give the district options for growth because there is room for additions, he said. Is that 10 years, 20 years down the line? We don't know, Biting said. The goal is for us to set up this building so it will be good for the future.
New headquarters for fire, police, city, county, Federal Credit Union. By Lisa Green, the Journal-Gazette. Fire, police, city, county, Federal Credit Union announced Wednesday plans to break ground next month on a headquarters at North Clinton Street and Penn Avenue. The project will cost about $13 million, a spokesman said through email. The new building will have about 22,000 square feet, including a full-service branch to accommodate the credit union's growth in recent years. The credit union has more than 11,300 members at six branches in Fort Wayne and New Haven and has experienced a 7% membership increase over the last 5 years, the news release said. The credit union's assets have grown about 46%. As our membership continues to grow, it's essential that we grow with it, Diane Shearer, president and CEO of the credit union, said. The new headquarters represents the credit union's ongoing commitment to providing exceptional service, expanding its capabilities, and investing in the future, she said. We're excited to build a space that reflects our values and enhances the experience for both our members and our team, Shearer added. Plans for the new headquarters were announced at the credit union's annual meeting, the release said. The groundbreaking is scheduled for October 9th, and a branch located at the site is expected to open in early 2027. Fire, police, city, county, federal credit union was founded in 1933 as the Fort Wayne Firefighters Credit Union. It has eight core membership groups, including area fire departments, law enforcement, and the city of Fort Wayne. Membership is also open to employees and volunteers of more than 360 select employee groups and their family members, the news release said. After more than 90 years of serving our members, we're not just building a headquarters, we're building a legacy for the next generation, said Nikki Felger, the credit union's executive vice president. Strebig Construction, Inc. is the general contractor for the project, and Martin Riley Architects Engineers is the building's architect. Once the new facility is completed, the credit union plans to decommission its main branch location at 3306 North Clinton Street, which sits north of the property on which the new headquarters will be constructed.
Patriot Day, a New Haven tradition. Beautification, car seat clinic, among services provided. New Haven volunteers today will again focus on acts of service to honor Patriot Day, which annually recognizes the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. New Haven is one of many communities across the country participating in the Day of Service. The city started its tradition in 2020. Volunteers from SDI, Lafarga Copper Works, and Lake City Bank will help with a community beautification project led by the United Way of Allen County. A New Haven news release said that project starts at 8:30 a.m. today at the 909 Community Gathering Place on Main Street. The beautification will include trash removal, cleaning, and wall painting. The city will also host a car seat safety inspection clinic from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Fire Station No. 3 at 910 Hertzel Road. Certified technicians will inspect and install car seats for families who have registered. Technicians will also give car seats to those who don't already have one, an effort supported by DuPont Hospital and Indiana University. Healthier moms and babies will distribute free diapers. The city has chosen various acts of service to incorporate into Patriot Day. Like many of our initiatives, Patriot Day began in New Haven as a way to reconnect following the isolation of the pandemic and make a positive difference on such a solemn day, New Haven Mayor Steve McMichael said in a statement. Our code enforcement officers saw residents in need, and we knew we had to find a way to mobilize the community to serve one another. Our team is dedicated now more than ever to extend a helping hand to our neighbors on September 11th and every other day.
And in Fort Wayne, Allen County news briefs, residents warned about email scam. The Allen County Commissioners Wednesday alerted residents to an email scam that claims to be a legitimate message from the Department of Planning Services. It appears that companies and individuals who have applications with the Board of Zoning Appeals are being targeted with fake invoices that look as if they came from the city of Fort Wayne. One example of the bogus emails claims a company owes a non-refundable processing fee of $4,980 as part of the application renew process. The scam email says payment is required by wire transfer. County and city officials urge anyone who receives an invoice supposedly from the Department of Planning Services to verify the message by contacting the office. The Department of Planning Services can be reached by calling 260-449-7607 or emailing acfwdps.permitsspecialist@allencounty.us. The office is on the first floor of the Citizens Square Building, 200 East Berry Street, Suite 150, Fort Wayne. Fundraiser set for football game. While Leo and New Haven High School's football teams meet on the field Friday night at Leo, the school's student councils will be in the stands collecting donations for the Alzheimer's Association. Organizers are calling it the Battle of the Brains fundraiser. During the game, each school will rally fans and community members to donate to their Walk to End Alzheimer's team. Proceeds will support Alzheimer's research, care, and free programs for families across Indiana who are affected by the disease. Alzheimer's affects more than 7 million Americans, including more than 121,300 Hoosiers, making this cause deeply personal for many Indiana families. The energy, school spirit, and student leadership behind this event make it a powerful example of how young people are stepping up to make a difference in their community, a Wednesday news release said. FW Trails gives to New Haven Parks. The Fort Wayne Trails staff on Wednesday donated $12,000 to New Haven Parks and Recreation Parks. The money will be used for maintenance, including pressure washing and board replacement on all of the boardwalk under New Haven management, more than 1,680 linear feet. James Holm, Fort Wayne Trails Community Engagement Director, said safety concerns prompted the donation. As an advocacy organization, we often communicate directly with trail users, granting us a unique wheels-on-the-ground perspective of what is happening on the trails. We have had many conversations about the potential for these boardwalks to be slippery when wet, and it has been many years since they have been pressure washed, he said in a statement. Fort Wayne Trails, Inc. advocates for a safe, accessible trail system that improves quality of life in Allen County. The system includes more than 152 miles of trails. And in the area, Carpenters Union to host open house. The Central Midwest Carpenters Union is hosting an open house from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. today at 1095 Mariners Drive, Warsaw, for students and people of all ages interested in exploring exciting careers in carpentry. Lunch will be provided. It is one of five free events statewide that showcase hands-on training career opportunities and the benefits of a debt-free path to a rewarding career in carpentry, according to a news release. Attendees will have the opportunity to meet current apprentices, instructors, and contractors, tour the training center, participate in hands-on activities, and learn about the diverse career paths available in the skilled trades. The demand for skilled construction workers in Indiana is surging. Large-scale infrastructure projects, commercial developments, and housing needs are creating opportunities for carpenters and opening doors for men and women looking for a career that offers hands-on experience without college debt, the release said.
Redistrict caucus ends. No specifics. State GOP senators silent. Outside group urges action. Whitney Downard and Nikki Kelly, courtesy of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. Senate Republicans met behind closed doors Wednesday at the Indiana State House, roughly 3 weeks after their House counterparts discussed redistricting, though none shared specifics with media following the caucus. Senate President pro tempore Roderick Bray, who leads the Republican body, declined to comment as he left the Senate caucus room. Also Wednesday, a national poll found that most Republicans want to ban mid-election redistricting, even as a group sends text encouraging Hoosiers to support the move. The two-hour meeting follows a Washington, D.C. trip last month where Bray and House Speaker Todd Houston met personally with Donald Trump to discuss redistricting. Trump and his allies have identified Indiana as an opportunity to grow the slim Republican majority in Congress. Just two of Indiana's nine congressional districts are held by Democrats, limiting pickup opportunities. But with Republican supermajorities in both chambers and a GOP governor, there's little opponents can do to halt the process. Despite the pressure, Indiana's leaders haven't yet scheduled a special session, and the vast majority of Republican lawmakers have been silent on the issue. Several other senators leaving Wednesday's meeting also declined to comment or share their perspective, though both Senators Spencer Deary and Greg Walker have been vocal about their opposition. The state's entire Republican delegation in the U.S. House has come out in favor of redistricting, though doing so will shift the boundary lines of their districts. Congressional representatives aren't required to live in the area they serve. Members of the House Republican Caucus are set to meet Friday. Redistricting support. Texts sent from the conservative-leaning Forward America started showing back up Tuesday, urging Hoosiers to contact their local representative to support redistricting. Radical representatives like Gavin Newsom, J.B. Pritzker, and Kathy Hochul are plotting to stop President Trump's agenda by redistricting their states and wiping out the conservative majority in Congress. Our state legislators have the power to counter the radical progressives' power grab by doing our own redistricting here in Indiana, one message read. The U.S. Constitution requires a count of all persons every 10 years. So far, the only state that has redistricted off-cycle is Texas, a Republican state. Another red state, Missouri, is in the middle of a special session doing the same. Forward America is also responsible for robocalls to Hoosiers last month, resulting in several complaints to the Attorney General's office. That office didn't return a request seeking an update. The group is registered in the Internal Revenue Service as 501c4 nonprofit out of Alexandria, Virginia. The principal officer is Blaze Hazelwood, a Republican strategist and consultant. Forward America has been around since at least 2019 and reported gross receipts of less than $50,000 for the 2024 tax period. It doesn't have to make public its donors, which is why some refer to it as dark money. Hazelwood is the owner of Grassroots Targeting LLC, a micro-targeting company that tailors messages to certain voters. She served as the Republican National Committee's political director in 2002 and 2004, and spearheaded the development of Voter Vault, the first online national voter file, her company bio said. Hazelwood launched Grassroots in 2005 to, quote, provide accurate and actionable data, modeling every precinct in the nation. The firm has consulted on winning presidential, senatorial, and congressional campaigns, as well as 19 governors. Hazelwood did not return a call seeking comment in the Capital Chronicle. Poll against redistricting. The same day as the GOP caucus, voting rights advocate Common Cause released a poll reporting that 64% of Republican and independent voters want to ban mid-decade redistricting. Common Cause commissioned Noble Predictive Insights to conduct the poll between August 26th and September 2nd. It surveyed more than 2,000 registered voters nationally and an additional 400 to 500 registered voters in Florida, Texas, New York, Illinois, and California. In very clear terms, our poll shows that even Republicans in red states like Indiana don't want mid-decade redistricting, said Julia Vaughn, the executive director of Common Cause Indiana. But this White House is insistent on trying to twist the arms of Indiana lawmakers, and we urge lawmakers in Indiana and Washington to follow the data and put an end to gerrymandering once and for all. Additionally, the poll found that the majority of voters in each state supported independent commissions to draw district boundaries rather than state lawmakers. 60% of voters who supported Trump in 2024 reportedly want Congress to ban mid-decade redistricting. A left-leaning pollster last month similarly concluded that the majority of Hoosiers, or 52%, opposed redrawing the maps. Traditionally, districts are redrawn following a once-in-a-decade census. The state's current maps were drawn in 2021.
NDOT seeks diversity rules waiver. Contractors' requirements unconstitutional. Rokita. By Leslie Bonilla Muniz, Indiana Capital Chronicle. Indiana's Department of Transportation has asked its federal counterpart to temporarily excuse it from diverse contractor requirements, which the state's attorney general has dubbed unconstitutional. The Hoosier State is the first to request a waiver, filing with the U.S. Department of Transportation late last month, according to a Tuesday news release. The move was prompted by a preliminary injunction in a federal case featuring a disgruntled Indiana subcontractor. I am a firm believer in offering equal opportunity for all to compete and succeed, Governor Mike Braun said in the release. If granted, this waiver will further position Indiana as a state one would want to do business with and as a place to grow your business. U.S. Department of Transportation regulations require state and local transportation agencies that receive highway, transit, and airport assistance to establish contracting goals for the participation of disadvantaged business enterprises that are majority-owned and controlled by socially and economically disadvantaged individuals. Anyone can qualify as disadvantaged, subjected to racial, ethnic, or cultural prejudice, or on a case-by-case basis. But some are presumed to be disadvantaged: women and Black, Hispanic, Native, and Asian Americans. There are personal net worth, business size, and gross receipts standards, however. Forcing NDOT to prioritize contractors based on race or gender is unconstitutional and undermines fair competition, said Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita, who authored a Friday letter in support of the agency's waiver request. The letter, also signed by the attorneys general of 16 other states, argued that white or male business owners don't benefit from the race and gender presumption. That's plainly discriminatory and therefore unconstitutional, the letter added. In the release, Rokita said a granted waiver would be a critical step toward ensuring that Indiana's transportation projects are awarded based on merit, not arbitrary classifications, and aligns with our constitutional duty to uphold equal protection under the law. Under its proposed waiver, NDOT would go race and gender neutral. A new methodology for setting goals and certifying businesses would consider how available economically disadvantaged small businesses are in certain geographies and industries, according to the release. The agency asked for a 3-year exemption, which would end around the time the agency's next disparity study is expected to be complete. The results will be used to create a new disadvantaged business goal based solely on economic criteria. NDOT will keep offering business development programming, virtual learning forums, and networking events to DBEs across Indiana. It's the latest step state officials have taken against diverse contracting efforts. Braun's Department of Administration is also seeking an opinion from Rokita's office about the legality of the Governor's Commission on Supplier Diversity and the Minority and Women's Business Enterprises Program. That agency's Division of Supplier Diversity has called off its next meeting until the review is completed, although opinions are non-binding. The division has also canceled its annual business conference and Be to Bloom Expo, which showcases opportunities for underrepresented companies to contract with state government.
Ratepayer advocate nixes Indianapolis utility hike. Agency proposes $21 million in cuts. From Leslie Bonilla Muniz of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. The Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor on Wednesday recommended that state regulators deny AES Indiana's request for a $193 million base rate increase, instead proposing a $21 million reduction in current rates. AES Indiana is a utility formerly called Indianapolis Power and Light. The agency's conclusions come after a 3-month legal and technical review of testimony and exhibits in the pending case, which is before the powerful Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. Freshly appointed Counselor Abby Gray said AES, quote, has not demonstrated sufficient evidence for a hike, noting that the utility filed its ask less than 14 months after nabbing approval on a previous rate case. My team is recommending additional reductions that would reduce the utility's current rates and help lessen the burden on ratepayers, Gray continued in a news release. The OUCC said on Tuesday that it filed testimony from 11 agency experts. The agency recommends that, quote, AES's monthly consumer customer service charge be cut from $17 to $11.25. The utility wants to raise it to $20. The authorized return on equity should be reduced from 9.9% to 8.5%. AES has asked for an increase to 10.7%. More than 100, quote, phantom hires in the utility's budgets must be eliminated. AES wants to charge ratepayers to fill 105 open roles that one filing described as, quote, continually vacant, with, quote, costs that are consistently non-incurred. Proposed expenses for depreciation, operations, and maintenance be decreased, and vegetation control costs be kept flat. Electric Division Director Brian Latham, the lead witness, said AES's case-in-chief, quote, appears to simply give lip service to affordability while focusing on shareholder returns. He noted that residential customers paid 25% more this year than in 2023. AES's rebuttal testimony is due October 7th. Also included in the OUCC's filings were more than 6,800 written comments from AES customers and other stakeholders. The agency has gotten, quote, significant numbers of written comments in recent rate cases for other investor-owned utilities, but, quote, no recent individual rate case has produced as many as the OUCC has received in this docket, External Affairs Specialist Ashley Bishop testified. Another 89 AES customers spoke, all in opposition, of about 500 attendees to four public hearings, held around Marion County, according to their filing. We received thousands of consumer comments in this case, highlighting serious hardships many customers are facing, Gray said, and I want to thank the individuals who took the time to submit comments either in writing or to the IURC's public hearings. Citizens Action Coalition, a nonprofit that advocates for ratepayers, also filed testimony urging denial and calling for greater affordability. The commission should take strong action to protect residential ratepayers experiencing inexcusably poor service at increasingly unaffordable rates, Program Director Ben Inskeep said in a separate news release. They have, quote, grown beyond exasperated with the AES Indiana's persistent billing and auto pay issues, the woefully inadequate customer services, and overall responses to AES Indiana's mismanaged billing and auto pay systems. After AES files its rebuttals, an IURC evidentiary hearing is scheduled to begin November 3rd. A final order is expected in the spring.
Millions volunteer services as part of 9/11 Day Project by Associated Press, Dateline, New York. When longtime friends David Payne and Jay Winnick set out to encourage people to take part in volunteer and service projects on the anniversary of the September 11, 2001 attacks, their goal was simple: to turn a day of unimaginable tragedy into a day for doing good. Now, as the nation prepares to mark the 24th anniversary of 9/11, that lofty mission has evolved into a national day of service, where people across the country participate in projects that honor the nearly 3,000 dead. The nationwide effort kicked off Wednesday as thousands of volunteers began assembling packaged meals for needy New Yorkers in a festive atmosphere aboard the USS Intrepid. Teams of volunteers filled small plastic bags with various ingredients for making a kind of jambalaya, including uncooked rice, dehydrated vegetables, lentils, salt, and other seasonings, as a DJ blasted upbeat tunes from the wing of an aircraft carrier turned museum. The vision was to create a ritual, said Winnick, co-founder and an executive vice president of 9/11 Day, the nonprofit organizing the event. We couldn't know what it would continue to resonate with people more than two decades later. The two-day event, which runs through today, aims to package more than 2 million meals for local food banks. It is among 25 large-scale volunteer service projects being organized in some two dozen cities across the country, including Chicago. Overall, 9/11 Day estimates some 30 million Americans will participate in some form with the Day of Service, which Congress enshrined into law in 2009. Beside meal packing, volunteers will be taking part in food and clothing drives, park and neighborhood cleanups, blood banks, and other community events, the organization says. Even smaller acts of kindness count, like greeting strangers on the street or holding the door for someone. It's really just meant to be a day when we remember and rekindle the way we all felt and the way that we all behaved in the immediate aftermath of the attack, said Payne, who co-founded 9/11 Day and is the president. When we weren't red states or blue states, we were just human beings wanting to help one another. Winnick said it's been gratifying to see Americans embrace the call to service and good deeds. His brother, Glenn Winnick, died on September 11th while serving as a volunteer firefighter and EMT. Glenn would have been first in line for this kind of thing. He lived his life and died in service to other people. He said, the call seems to be resonating in particular with the some 100 million younger Americans born after the 2001 attacks, Payne added. The amazing thing about 9/11 was that it brought our country together in a way that we had never experienced before. And I think there's a longing for that sense of unity again, he said. I think that's especially true for young people deeply discouraged by the kind of division, divisiveness that they see, that they are feeling.
Kiss My Grits actress Polly Holiday dies. Dateline New York. Polly Holiday, a Tony Award-nominated screen and stage actor who turned the catchphrase "Kiss My Grits" into a national retort as the gum-chewing, beehive-wearing waitress aboard the long-running CBS sitcom Alice, has died. She was 88. Holiday died Tuesday at her home in New York, said her theatrical agent, Dennis Asplund. She was the last surviving member of a principal cast of Alice. Linda Lavin, who played the title character, died last year. Alice ran from 1976 to 1985, but Holiday had become such a star that the network gave her her own short-lived spinoff called Flo in 1980. It lasted a year. Holiday earned 4 Golden Globe nominations and won one in 1980 for Alice, as well as 4 Emmy Award nominations. As for the Kiss My Grits line, the Alabama-born Holiday distanced herself from it, telling interviewers it was not pure Hollywood and not a regional saying, but she identified with Flo. She was a Southern woman, you see it in a lot of places, she told the Sarasota Herald Tribune in 2003. Not well educated, but very sharp, with a sense of humor and a resolve not to let life get her down.
That concludes the news from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette for Thursday, September 11th. We will now take a short break and return with obituaries and features from the living section.